All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, it's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Let's go back to the phone lines and Tom from L.A. Hey, Tom, thanks for waiting. You say what?
Hey, I have a question because I've actually been doing a little bit of research, and I wanted to ask Sandy and yourself, Earl, is it true that the United States made some type of deal with Ukraine years ago about dropping their nuclear weapons and dropping their defense ability with the United States?
Yeah, there in 1994, it was called the Budapest Accord. Russia, the United States, Ukraine, and I don't know if there were other signatories, entered into an agreement. But actually, both Russia and the United States were terribly nervous about Ukraine, but Ukraine holding a very big arsenal of nuclear weapons. And the reason was that at that point, and maybe continuing, but at that point, the Ukraine government was known to be a very corrupt sieve. It was a republic that was 3 years old. They had inherited a big nuclear arsenal because, much like Montana and some other states in the United States, it ended up that the Soviet Union had decided to have a big arsenal of nuclear missiles located geographically in Ukraine. And so Ukraine had control over a lot of nuclear weapons, and the concern was that they would be sold to all the highest bidder across the world, and we would end up with a proliferation of nuclear weapons in a very dangerous way. And so both the United States and Russia were signatories to the Budapest Accord, and we agreed that they would give up their weapons, and that both and the United States would protect. The sanctity of the geographic boundaries of Ukraine, and so would Russia, and then there were other terms of that accord which Russia would now claim had been violated based on the neutrality, the notion that Ukraine's neutrality would be protected by those parties, because Russia's assertion is that all of the flirtation with NATO and the expansion of NATO was itself a violation of the Budapest Accord. So yes, it was signed.
So, Sandy, is that part of the reason why we're in the mess that we're in, though? Because they would have been able to defend themselves if against Russia.
Well, yeah, some people are saying that now, but everyone's forgetting that the terror that we all had, that if those weapons were in the hands of Ukraine, we would have been defending ourselves against threats of bombs, dirty bombs, and real bombs coming from terrorists in the Mideast who would have bid high prices to buy this out of the corrupt country that was holding those arsenals. So I don't think many people questioned the wisdom of getting the nuclear weapons out of the hands of Ukraine as it was constituted in 1994. I think the world at large was very interested in accomplishing that outcome.
All right. I was just wondering because I'd researched that and saw that and thought maybe that's part of the reason why. I mean, I'm sure it's for us to get, you know, money up for arms and the military industrial complex. But also I'm looking at it in terms of if we made them get rid of made a deal with them to get rid of their weapons and they have no defense now, then that might be part of the reason, too, why we're kind of in the quagmire we're in.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think the Clinton administration that negotiated that and the administration, which then was Yeltsin, I believe, that negotiated it, were just intent on the objective I described. The arms all went back to Russia. And so, I would disagree with anyone who thinks that we foolishly and deceptively got them to give up their arms, and that if they'd held those arms, they could now have those arms in a position to be a deterrent against the aggression from Russia. Yes, it would be a deterrent if they still held them, but the question is, would the world have been subjected to a huge threat as the result of what might have happened to some of those weapons?
All right, Tom, thank you very much for the call. You know, Sandy, CIA Director William Burns said Russian President Vladimir Putin is too confident that he can defeat Ukraine as China considers providing lethal military aid to Moscow. I don't think that the fact that Vladimir Putin believes that they can defeat Ukraine is anything other than factual. If Russia can't defeat Ukraine, as powerful as Russia is, and yes, they're paying a major price for it, why would we think that's crazy thinking for Russia to think that?
Well, I would guess that Burns, if you put him in a private room, would say yes. If Russia has the appetite to extend this war as long as it might need to extend this war to vanquish Ukraine in its entirety militarily, it could do that. I also think that everyone who's savvy about this understands that Russia, and no longer, even whether it had this aspiration at the beginning of the war, and I don't believe it did, but if it held the aspiration to conquer all of Ukraine, it wouldn't exercise it, because occupying particularly Western Ukraine would be a festering cancer that would be a very long-term insurgency war that would dwarf the kind of problems that have been experienced elsewhere in the world when someone tries to occupy a country against its will. With ongoing sanctions of Russia that would then go in perpetuity, the world would have that problem, and we would have the constant irritation internationally of feeding weapons and support to the insurgents in Ukraine, which would be a constant worldwide festering wound. That's part of the problem with everyone who talks about this needs to talk about what's the end game and what will it look like to the world. What's the end game of this war? And when you get done analyzing all that, you really come to the inevitable conclusion that there needs to be a negotiated settlement. It undoubtedly will give Ukraine comfort that it has a distinct sovereign nation boundaries, that probably that won't include the Donbass and the land bridge to Crimea and Crimea, that will undoubtedly get ceded to Russia in a formal sort of a way, and that ultimately will work out a situation that will allow the world to drop its sanctions against Russia and will maintain the integrity of the revised Ukraine.
So, Sandy, the majority of the American people still, this is not on their radar. Not going to be on their radars. I don't know what it's going to take to bring it to their attention, because there's so many other things going on that they don't see this as something. It's happening over there. And so as you keep saying, it's not happening in our country, and so we don't feel a threat as the American people that this is something that's paramount and something that we need to be focusing on. We don't see that.
Well, I know we don't see that. And it allows us, I think, to foolishly not think through the whole game. And politically, we have the problem that domestic politics has a very short time horizon in which they behave. And so, you know, we have sort of a rah-rah attitude, for instance, towards China now. And we talk about needing to defeat China when they invade Taiwan. And we're beginning to talk about that like it's an inevitable, it's going to happen. We have constant press releases, leaks from the Pentagon saying we think it could happen in 2025 or, you know, whatever. And all of that creates an increased likelihood that it will happen, because the more hostily we talk about it, the more we behave like we're trying to arm Taiwan into a situation where they could declare their independence from China, okay? China has long said that a red line was that Taiwan is part of China, and they've been willing to treat Taiwan as give it some autonomy in the way it governs itself, much the way it has given some autonomy to Hong Kong, which it is beginning to withdraw now. But, you know, what we need to think about is, how does it end up? If we get into a conflict with China, with an actual war in Taiwan, and they invade Taiwan, and we decide to throw ourselves mightily into that conflict, what's the end game? How does that end up?
So, Sandy, it's pretty clear that we're preparing ourselves for something you just talked about, because we're putting more troops on the ground. And so to me, that's a dare to China, because we're sending more troops in the face of what we think is inevitable. Our nation believes that that's going to happen. And you would think that what our nation would be doing would be, well, I don't know if we're willing to get bogged down in this. Maybe we need to be pulling our troops out, Sandy, not adding more.
Well, I think the problem is that our world policy during the Cold War, sort of the George Kennan-originated policy of containment, we recognized the USSR, and we recognized that it had a sphere of influence, and we recognized that we weren't going to try and erode that sphere of influence, and we recognized what the problems would be about that. So we went through this period of what was called realpolitik, and John Mearsheimer, this professor at University of Chicago, was a champion of it, and Henry Kissinger was a champion of it. It was what formulated our policy. Upon the collapse of the USSR, things changed, and China was not yet an international power. We were the only international power, and instead of recognizing that there were competing hegemonies, competing spheres of influence in the world with powerful countries, we decided that we were the only powerful country in the world, and we were going to exert this sort of what I call hegemony over the world. And we have continued to behave that way in spite of the fact that Russia has gotten back on its feet, at least with respect to its military capacity, and China has clearly become a world economic power.
Listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. It's Mondays with Sandy Williams. Dan is back. Hey, Dan, how you doing? You say what?
Good. I actually have a pretty serious question for Sandy, and that is, with all this rhetoric against China and Taiwan and all this military buildup, do you actually think that this could reignite a conflict on the Korean Peninsula? Because, I mean, if you look back in history, we got too close to China, and they didn't want us in their sphere of influence. Do you actually think this could reignite a conflict on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, I'm not sure how related they are. And I mean, I think that the North, you know, the problem we have with the whole North Korea-South Korea thing is there never was a peace declared from the Korean War. So we have a technically speaking, the war that was waging in the early 50s has never been settled officially. And so we've got this sort of tenuous prospect between North and South Vietnam, North and South Korea that is ongoing. I don't in my own mind connect dots between the situations that we've got with China and North and South Korea. China has a very iffy relationship with North Korea. I think North Korea is a rogue government in many respects, unreliable as an ally from any direction. And I think that China is careful about the way it supports Korea and North Korea in particular. So I guess my answer is I don't think the two of them are related, but I think that Korea is a little bit of a tinderbox. And so I don't quite understand what North Korea's objectives are. They talk about unification, and actually there's talk of unification in South Korea too. So that I do sort of believe that some morning we'll wake up and we'll find out that the Koreas are unified, and that the North Korea will go the way of East Germany, and will be absorbed by the much stronger economy, and that the people of North Korea will end up experiencing the prosperity, or some of it, that the South Koreans have. But that could take decades.
All right, Dan?
Another comment I wanted to make was, we can't continue to be the world's police. We just can't continue. It's not sustainable anymore.
Let me ask you, because, and Sandy, the question really is directed towards you. We think that this is about us being the world's police, but I think it's something more than that.
Well, I think the question is, what's in it for us to be the world's police, and why do we do it? And I think it has to do with this. It's sort of almost like a DNA, and the people who push this realist view of international affairs, the idea of regional influence, have a view that it's in the DNA of an economically powerful entity to push the range of its influence as far as possible in order to protect the sanctity of their economic might. And so those people would say that in the vacuum that occurred at the collapse of the USSR, the United States was the only one standing, and we pushed that sphere of influence to its ultimate extreme, which was worldwide. And we're having trouble revising our notion of that as the rest of the world is gotten off its knees, in particular China. I mean, China's a totally different entity today than it was in 1991 when the USSR collapsed. And for that matter, when the USSR collapsed, all of the ex-republics of the USSR were really in a state of vacuum. They were a state of political vacuum, and even Russia was floundering greatly and had huge economic problems internal to it and was in no position to carry out anything worldwide. So we were operating in a vacuum, much like the vacuum we had after World War II. And the world is caught up to us after World War II, and the world is caught up to us after the collapse of the USSR. And so you're absolutely right. We're going to have to pull in our horns, but we have to do it by having a self-realization that we're no longer in that vacuum situation, and we better start recognizing the real interests of these competing economic entities, or we are going to get into serious trouble.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for the call. You know, though, Sandy, it's getting more and more involved, almost on a weekly, on a daily basis, where we are with all of this. And every time I look up, we're hearing more from Russia's political leadership. And they, many, you know, early on, we were believing, had us believing that the Russian people were totally against this. And now the Russian people are saying they're kind of united.
Well, and in fact, the polling that's been done, now, of course, polling in Russia must be an extremely difficult thing to carry out and get results you can trust, but the early polling showed 80% support. Now it's 70%, the polls that are being conducted, which the West gets access to. Now, what does that mean? I don't know, but our various news agencies have gone over and interviewed people on the street in Russia, and they're finding that there's significant support for the Russian situation. They attribute it to the propaganda and the news filter that is applied to all the news in Russia, which is giving them a biased view of things. I would point out that our news gives us a biased view of things as well. I mean, you know, I think all of us have to understand that, particularly in this Ukraine situation, without independent war correspondents on the ground, we're dealing with news from the front in Ukraine, and the West is dealing with Ukrainian press releases, and the Russians are dealing with Russian press releases, and our view of the situation is totally colored by that.
We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more.
Well,
don't you come back no more.
What you said?
Don't
Sandy.
Don't you come back no more.
You can't mean that.
Don't you come back
no
more.
Oh, now, baby, please.
Don't you come back no more.
What you trying to do to me?
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. Sandy, I want to pivot a little bit to the economy again and what your thoughts are, because, you know, it's hard to measure, right? What's going on?
Well, it is hard to measure. Economists and financial folks flounder. They keep looking to see whether there's some startling piece of dispositive news. You know, this news right now is the important piece of news that will tell us whether it's the important tea leaf that will tell us whether we're headed to a recession or what. So, you know, the labor news last week was showed a very, you know, record low unemployment, lots of new jobs being filled. It was the kind of news that suggested that the Fed might have to keep increasing interest rates in order to stifle demand. And, you know, I have a question in my own mind whether we shouldn't find a tool different than interest to deal with it, maybe like tax increases or fiscal policy. You know, it's easy to rely on the Fed because it's non-political. It doesn't require congressional action. It's just this private entity group of people can go and take action and do stuff. But, the tea leaves continue to be mixed. We've got inflation that is coming down, but it continues to be – the core inflation is still close to 5%, which is well down from what it was. Core inflation is the inflation measure excluding food and energy costs, which are the most volatile costs, which are the quickest to run up in a period of shortage and inflation. And so inflation is down, but it's not coming down as quickly maybe as they hoped. So now there's a view that maybe interest rates will have to keep rising. Somehow the stock market looks at that and says, uh-oh, that's going to impact the future value of earnings. If interest stays high and the value of investing in federal instruments has gone up, which makes it less valuable alternatively to be in the stock market, there's all these things that are happening, but it's dynamic. But actually, it's still hard to predict that there's going to be a recession around the corner. I was much more alarmed and ringing the alarm bells a year ago and 2 years ago than I am right now, quite frankly. The United States economy seems to have some solidity under it. And, you know, as long as people are employed and as long as inflation slows down, you know, it is true that everybody, rich and poor, is talking about prices in the grocery store. And that's a problem for the incumbent government, so long as people think those grocery store prices are high. But it looks to me like, at least in this last election cycle, the public was a little more savvy about blaming the incumbent politicians for the level of inflation that was occurring in a period like today, where we've got all these other influences causing inflation, shortages, wars, pandemic, et cetera.
You know, Sandy, people are still buying houses.
Although the housing market has slowed down, and nationally the data shows that prices have come down. In fact, prices on houses fell more in, I can't remember if the period was 6 months or what it was, than they have since 2008. They fell 5%.
So here's when you see that the prices of houses had gone through the roof a year or two ago because everybody was buying houses, and And now all of a sudden you bought that house 2 years ago at an inflated rate. And now the price of homes has come down.
Yeah.
You wind up losing on that, huh?
Well, you lose on it if you sell the house. You know, it's a little bit like owning stock. You don't make a gain until you sell the stock, and you don't incur a loss till you sell it. It is true, however, that when houses go down in value, people feel less wealthy. So if you owned a house that you thought was worth $1 million and now you think it's worth $600,000, that's a dark cloud hanging over your head in terms of your sense of wealth. And if you don't feel you're as wealthy as you used to feel, then you don't buy as much as you used to buy. And so it is true that during periods of falling home prices, it tends to affect demand, and we have a consumption-driven economy. So that can have an effect on the economy, whether those people sell their houses or not. You know, the other thing we've got that's been written about recently that economists have to scratch their head about is when you're doing year-on-year comparisons, and that's sort of the most accurate way to look at financial measurements. But when last year was an extremely unusual year, when prices were way up last year, when prices come down 10% from last year, they might just be going back to something much more like a norm. So instead of taking the view that you've got falling prices that portend continued falling prices, you might just have price adjustments going back to a norm and a normal kind of a trend line that was ongoing before. And that's probably currently what's happening in the housing market. It's a twofold effect, a sobering up, number one, and number two, people were buying those houses a year and a half ago when interest rates were still so low, so they could go out and get a mortgage cheap, and they could spend a bunch on a house, and they decided they'd do it now, and maybe they decided to do it now because they were smart enough to know mortgage rates were going to go up, which they've done. And when mortgage rates go up, you can't spend as much on a house.
You know, and I do understand that there are people who, especially first-time home buyers, who clearly have made up their minds, sometimes even detrimentally, we want to buy this house, we're going to buy it, and first-time home buyers aren't concerned with those things because it's their time, it's their opportunity, and they're going to buy it regardless. You're probably saying long-term, hanging on to it, they'll wind up better off than if...
Well, post-World War II, the American... The people in participating in the American economy were allowed to believe the notion that long-term the value of a house goes up. Hold on to it long enough and it goes up. It's a little bit like the long-term in the stock market. Hold on to a stock long enough and its price will go up so long as the business remains viable. And maybe that's not necessarily true. And before World War II, people used to buy homes to own a home. They didn't buy a home with the notion that they were going to flip it and make money right by selling it. They bought a home because they wanted to have a place that was theirs, that they built to conform with their tastes, that they wanted it to be a comfortable home for them and their children. It would be the home that all of them would think about as their permanent home. Homes were homes. They weren't just houses that you lived in for a while and flipped. And so, and they weren't necessarily things that anyone thought they would make money on. People spent money disproportionate, probably to the value of the house, in order to make the house be what they wanted it to be. And that was reflected. If you look at a home built in the 1920s, you can see that. All kinds of expensive built-in things. Homes were built with a high degree of craftsmanship. People lived in right homes for entire lifetimes. And so... It could be that we'll return to the notion that if you want to buy a home, it's not because it's an investment, it's because it's a home. And it might be something that would depreciate in value rather than appreciate in value.
You know, when you look at all of the different things, and I know you were constantly saying that the businesses were hanging on to their employees. I was reading this article, and I forgot exactly where it was, but it said exactly what you said, that the businesses have made that decision to to hold on to their employees. And it was hard for me to accept that because I'm from the era that recession.
Yeah, you lived in the era of the layoff.
Yeah, of the layoff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just maybe not understanding what's going on in the minds of businesses and that they've changed over the decades.
It's interesting. You lived in an era of unionized layoff.
Right.
Unions had funds that they developed. When you got laid off, the union paid you some money during the period of your layoff, didn't it?
Not with the company I was with, okay. But in most union I was with, in UAW and those kind of things.
Yeah, they did. And so to some extent, the unions and the companies understood that these workers were going to be temporarily not paid by the company in order to get the company through its financial problem, but they were going to go back to work.
Yes, you knew that the job was there. The job hadn't left, and so that was when you really saw the transformation or the changes in things.
Yeah, but the layoffs that began to occur in the 1990s and thereafter were much more painful.
Yeah, well, they
because
were
there
permanent.
The people were laid off and it was permanent layoffs, and there was no promise of the job and there was no union relationship necessarily that plugged you back into the job. And so what occurred in the 1970s in the economy with the layoffs and the ability to lay workers off was much more humane and much different than what has occurred much more recently. And what happened recently with the notion of permanent layoffs caused this, you know, the pandemic layoffs have bitten a lot of the businesses in the behind when they tried to find workers to fill the jobs that were needed to be filled to accommodate the orders, the backlog of orders. I mean, there was a rush to fill the demand that had been vacated during the period of the pandemic, and yet there weren't any workers. Businesses left lots of money on the table. They don't want to do that again. And therefore, I think we're back to employees having a much more committed relationship that's bilateral to employers.
So do you at any point in the future see unions forming and being acceptable to corporations more so than we've seen in the last 30 years?
Could be. And certainly in some of the industries that have suffered the service industry, the industry that.
No, but the service industry's never had unions.
Some of it has. I mean, yeah. the restaurant, there's the developing union of the
SEIU.
Yeah, and some of those folks, you know, there's clearly been a change in the dynamic that is causing a change in the business model for the people who own restaurants, et cetera. Waiters and waitresses are much more likely to turn into career jobs. The whole notion of tipping is getting much more attention and question, because to cause your employees to rely on tipping is to make it less likely that it will be a professional job.
You know, when you that whole discussion about tipping, unless I guess you're in that line of work, you really don't understand it, right?
Well, no, and I had a son that was a waiter, and I didn't realize. I became a generous tipper after I understood the finances, the financial situation that he was in while he was in law school and graduate school, operating in a restaurant. But now tipping has kind of been turned on its head. You can go to places and it's you're ordering and you aren't having a waiter or waitress. You're simply ordering at a counter. You get it handed to you, and you get the opportunity to leave a tip. They turn the screen around, and you can tell them how much you're going to add on. And then I found out at some places that tip didn't go to the workers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I found out at a fast food place. I said, well, I'll give you a tip. He said, you don't have to do that. It doesn't go to us anyway. And so some places, that tip just goes to the employer as an added cushion.
I didn't know that.
And some places, it actually goes to the workers. And so I think there's going
to
be...
So you have to ask.
You have to ask. And I think there'll be a backlash ultimately by the consumer against tipping. And then the question is, they're going to have to realize that if they don't tip, the price of going to a restaurant is going to go up. But it's going to be an all-in price.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-9570. 2789 is the number. You're tuning into the Erlingham Show. We'll be right back. Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, I was going through this international. Zelensky shows some openness to China's ceasefire proposal. The question is, what follows the words? Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky signaled he is somewhat open to working with China on its ceasefire plan for the war between Russia and Ukraine. I believe that the fact that China started talking about Ukraine is not bad, but the question is what follows the words, Zelensky said at a press conference held this past Friday. The Associated Press reported China released a 12-point plan for trying to find a resolution in the conflict at the one-year anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The plan includes points calling for respecting all countries' sovereignty, ending hostilities, resuming peace talks, and resolving the humanitarian crisis that has been created by the war. So I don't think that China's the first country that's kind of echoed those sentiments. Why is he considering it with China, Sandy, as opposed to if Russia was, or if America was saying that?
Well, I don't think we have offered a peace proposal, but
which is crazy.
Yeah, which probably is a bit crazy. I think that the recent proposal coming from France, Germany, and Britain, which was basically saying, "Look, we're going to give you something like a NATO promise, but it's not going to be NATO. You know, it's going to be a unilateral promise from a bunch of European countries that we will protect your back and we will protect your military back if you go on to have discussions of peace," so that they can try and create a situation in which declaring a willingness to have peace talks would not be viewed as a declaration of surrender, essentially. And that's always the problem when you're at war, is if a party acts like they're eager to have talks, then the other side will view it as a sign of weakness, and they'll say, no, this isn't the time to talk. This is the time to step on your neck. And so both sides are, I think, right now very unwilling to do anything that would be viewed as enthusiasm towards peace talks. On the other hand, I think both sides are interested in it because both sides realize that the end game needs to be a negotiation. And I do think that the United States, whatever we're saying publicly, I do think the United States and Europe and European countries have more clearly been declaring that the Crimea is off limits. You're not going to be able to recover the Crimea, and we don't have the appetite to supply you with arms, and we don't have the duration of the war that it would take for you to fight and succeed in Crimea is beyond our appetite. And so, you know, if that's the case, then there needs to be a negotiated settlement, and the negotiated settlement will recognize the secession and the accession of Crimea to Russia. And so, yeah, there's going to be a negotiation, and my hope is that it will happen in the next several months.
You mean the beginning of negotiations?
Beginning of negotiations, and there's also talk of ceasefire for negotiations, and the fact that we have rather static battle lines is the kind of situation in which a ceasefire can be considered. Both sides probably need to essentially rejuvenate their military capacity, Russia and Ukraine. So a ceasefire falls into the mutual interest of both of them to strengthen their capacity to continue the war if they don't reach a settlement. So I do envision that there could be a ceasefire and a negotiation. You know, the horror of that is that if the negotiation doesn't work, both sides will have rejuvenated their military capacity, and they'll be in a position to have now an extended war.
So let's quickly bring in Gary from Sussex. Just bring him on, Kevin. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, hey, I this is off subject right now. I just want to finish what we were talking about last week when you were talking about Ron DeSantis and the open carry and all that stuff. I don't know if you guys are aware of the fact in Wisconsin we have open carry here. You don't need a permit. Just as long as you do not have a felony on your record or been beating up your wife or violence, anybody in Wisconsin can carry a gun, including you and Sandy, just as long as it's open. You cannot have concealed. Then you'll get arrested. But open carry is in Wisconsin. I don't know if you guys are aware of that.
Well, so what we were really talking about was the fact that you didn't need a permit. You even if you know there's a difference in Florida. They're talking about you don't need a permit to own the gun. In Wisconsin, you need a permit. There's a difference.
No, you don't.
Do we?
Oh,
no,
you don't.
I don't know if we need permits or not. I've never explored owning a handgun, so I'm totally in the dark. I guess that might well be the case, Gary. And however, I'll tell you, I don't feel any more secure today knowing that than I did before I didn't know it, and I don't feel any more secure after they passed that open carry than I did before. I probably feel a little less secure, but you know, again, guns are our religion in this country, and it's almost like we don't talk about politics or religion in social settings, and we don't really easily talk about guns and the right to have guns.
You know, Sandy, it's another weekend in Milwaukee and in parts around Milwaukee where more people were slayed. I don't have a love affair for guns.
Yeah.
And I really don't. And they cause more harm than should be.
Well, the number of homicides in America per capita, the number of gun deaths in America per capita, dwarf what happens any place else in the world, other than maybe the cartel nation of Mexico. I don't know what happens there, where there's actual lawlessness. But, you know, for me, I do connect dots there, and the dots I connect are the fact that we have so many guns in America that it makes it possible for people who get angry to shoot people.
Yeah. All right, Sandy, thank you very much. We got to go. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Kelvin. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.